Now, back to Stand Up with Pete Dominic on Indy, Sirius XM 104.
All right, yay, hour three is here, and so is our favorite policy expert, Dr. Aaron Carroll, now joins us. He's an expert, everybody. One of the best, if not the best. I love him. I'm in love with our next guest. Constantly concerned with what he thinks of me. And what else can I say? He's a professor of pediatrics and director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at Indiana University and author of Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths, Half-Truths, and Outright Lies About Your Body and Your Health. Most recent book is Don't Cross Your Eyes, They'll Get Stuck That Way. His blog, which is getting bigger and bigger, more and more popular, is The Incidental Economist. He tweets at Aaron E. Carroll, and he also puts out a video with YouTube star John Green every week called Healthcare Triage, and this week's is fantastic. It's about how Obamacare is paid for. We'll try to talk with him about that. Maybe we'll even play it and give him a break during the interview. And you just got back from Qatar. Can we talk about your trip? Is it shut up? Can we talk?
No.
Don't correct me.
Basically, it's sort of like the Eastern Hemisphere's big pediatric meeting, general pediatric meeting. It was very interesting.
The Eastern Hemisphere. We live in the Western Hemisphere.
Yes, because this one is like populated almost entirely by people coming from Europe or Asia.
And
that matter, yeah.
And so it's a pediatric convention of pediatricians.
Mostly pediatricians. I mean, there were probably some people there who were, maybe nurse practitioners, and medical assistants. I'd say the vast majority of people there were pediatricians. But it is a partially educational, partially research type meeting for general pediatrics. It's called Excellence in Pediatrics. I think it's been going for like 5 years.
And the country is Qatar. That's how it's pronounced, Qatar.
No, everyone disagrees. But I heard a story on the news, and as part of it, they actually went to the embassy and said, "How do you say it?" And they said it's like guitar, like the instrument is just guitar. So it's, I think that is how it is correctly pronounced. Although I think they're very accepting of almost any other pronunciation.
Although it is a Muslim country, is it not?
Yeah, fascinating. Revealed my prejudice. It was much more cosmopolitan and modern than I expected. And even the parts that were sort of older were very much in a sort of quaint or historical manner. Like their old market was very impressive, but shockingly clean. They had people there just constantly washing the stones and picking up trash. It was almost Disney-ish in its level of attention to detail and cleanliness.
How were you treated as a Jewish American in this Muslim
country? I didn't wear like anything that would alert, so I don't know how anyone would know that I was Jewish just upon looks. But as a person, I was treated very well. Again, I felt totally, people keep asking about safety and issues like this. Very safe.
Do women have to cover up in this country?
No, it was much less of that than you would expect. And I saw, even when I saw women in what I think would be traditional garb in the burqa or anything else, they often had, hot pink painted nails and high heels. So it was much more cosmopolitan than
that's
I
what I'm talking
I
about. You flew business class, first class, I would imagine?
They actually did fly business class, which was its own experience. I've never really done that before.
And what, that's a long flight. What airline did you fly, and what was that like? And so did they give you a lot of meals and massage,
crazy,
happy ending, et cetera?
Five-course dinner. Yeah, it's like a five-course dinner that ends with this Sunday bar that they, like, wheel up to your seat, and it's like, what topping would you like? And they have, it was crazy. Of course, it cost the meeting, I'm sure, a fortune to pay for that ticket, so Sunday bar was the least they could do. But it is a much nicer way to travel. I don't think I'd ever spend the money myself because it's so ridiculously expensive to fly that way. But much nicer than otherwise just sitting in a coach seat, I'll say that.
There are a number of studies that have come out that are saying things, every day it seems like one of my favorite websites, Newser, posts different studies that are saying things about your health and that you need to know. How do we know whether or not to trust these new developments, these new studies that come out constantly?
You ask me, of course.
All right, well.
Part of it is you could go read the study yourself and get good enough to judge.
Well, I can't read a study. Most people do agree. I mean, they have no.
Well, here's the thing.
The study is not written for a layman, for an uneducated person, necessarily.
That is true. I'm being partially facetious. I mean, but this is, okay. Again, this is, I mean, I'm being partially facetious because this is the argument for why our blog exists. is that you know, we try to bridge the gap between research and the rest of the world to try to translate it into terms that everybody can understand. But you know, a rule of thumb is if somebody tells you something causes something else, you know, it's like this is going to cause, you know, it's worth checking to see if it's a randomized controlled trial, because anything short of that, it's not causality, it's an association, and you know, no one knows whether it's causing it. The second thing is to learn the difference between absolute and relative risk. So, and this is worth spending a minute or two on. When you see the headlines and they're like, reduces the risk by 42% or something like that, you want to go look at the study and see whether they're talking about absolute or relative. A relative risk is a reduction from one thing to another. So if I reduce the risk of heart disease, say, by 50%, which sounds massive, but what I really did was reduce your chance of getting it from, like, you know, 2 in a million to 1 in a million, well, odds are it wasn't going to happen anyway. So, you know, a 50% reduction there just doesn't mean much. An absolute reduction in risk is basically one minus the other. So, you know, an absolute reduction of 2 in a million to 1 in a million is almost infinitesimal. An absolute reduction from 50% to 25%, however, would be an absolute reduction of 25%, and that's a big deal. So, you know, often a relative risk reduction of 50% is meaningless, while an absolute reduction of risk of 50% is massive. And so whenever you hear one of these, you know, if you drink red wine, it's going to reduce the risk of cancer by 42%, or if you drink alcohol, it's going to increase the risk of breast cancer by 33%. You know, it's always important to go and look and see whether they're talking about absolute or relative risk, because if they're talking about relative and the numbers are incredibly small to begin with, then it's not making that much of a difference in your life.
The brilliant Aaron Carroll is joining us, and you can join the conversation, ask him anything you want, and hijack my – I always am set for 1,000 questions, and I always want to agree you know, really take all of the time of our guest experts, but by all means, it's our conversation, and I want you to contribute to it. 866-994-6343. As always, your questions about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, your concerns, and I've got plenty of those myself that I want to get to. But on that study, on the study issue that you just explained, what we need to know, I see a bunch of things out right now, but one thing, we've talked about this before, about organic foods. There's a new study that says let me just read, the jury is still out on the health benefits of organic food, but,
yep.
And you agree with that?
Yes.
But organic milk appears to have some genuine advantages over conventional milk, according to new research. Almost 400 samples of both kinds of milk found that the organic stuff, from cows grazed in grassy pastures, was richer in heart-healthy fatty acids than milk from corn-fed cows, are reporting. All milk
makes me so irked.
There's, I don't have the information of the study. So.
Well, here's the thing. So
the finding published Monday.
I mean, we've done this before, but like I think I was on an episode where I railed against the milk industrial complex.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The only human beings that need milk are babies and small children. There is no other mammal on the planet which drinks milk outside of the neonatal or, you know, infant period. Because that's when milk is necessary, when you're breastfeeding, and that's when you get it. All the milk you consume after that date has to be taken from other animals because we're not necessarily supposed to get it. And that's why we drink cow's milk or picket goat's milk or something else. It's not something that's required. In fact, you know, we have to keep removing the fat from it because it's not terribly healthy. In fact, if you drink too much milk, it's incredibly bad for your gut and you start actually bleeding out. And we see a couple kids in the hospital every year who are there for shockingly horrific anemia because they've been bleeding slowly out of their GI tract because they've been drinking too much milk. And, you know, milk is full of fat. You know, that's why we have to keep making it into non-fat milk and other things. So when they start bragging about it having heart-healthy things, they're talking about old people or adults, because, of course, babies don't really need their omega-3 fatty acids to prevent heart disease. They're babies, and they're not getting it yet. But they're the ones who are supposed to get milk. And so we're certainly not worried about the heart-healthy stuff that's going to be in the milk for the babies. They're trying to pitch that kind of stuff at, I would imagine, older Americans or, you know, middle-aged people who don't need that much milk to begin with. So it's a bizarre thing to argue about anyway. And plus, that is a first-level thing. In other words, they're saying it has more omega fatty acids or whatever it is, great. How much more? Does it actually make a difference in people's lives? Like, in other words, if they drink the milk, do they actually see a reduction in heart disease? I'm positive they haven't proven that yet or studied that yet. Moreover, are the negative effects of drinking milk, the extra calories, everything else you're doing, more dangerous than the quote-unquote benefits that we don't even know?
We're talking about organic milk versus regular milk.
Why? It's like, what are the? Why are we trying to push people to drink milk more as adults? Like, why? Where's the?
Well, no, but we're not trying to push people to drink milk. But see, I want to know simply, Aaron, if I should be buying, because I don't drink milk. I put half and half in my coffee,
right. And
I bought for the first time organic half and half the other day, and I want to simply know if I should spend a little extra money to get a little healthier milk product.
But again, it's a healthier in what way? It's like, because they're telling you it has a tiny amount of organic, of like omega fatty acids in it. Is it an amount that would benefit you? Completely unknown, completely unproven. Let's get the bottom line. If you want to spend money on this stuff, you should feel free. It's a matter.
Organic production enhances milk nutritional quality by shifting fatty acid. This is the study. It's by PLOS1. And the editor of the study is one Andrea S. Wiley at Indiana University. I would imagine you guys lunch together.
No, we don't. But again, I'm not disputing the findings of the study. I guarantee you they did a test in a lab and showed a statistically significant increase in how much of these omega fatty or whatever they are in the milk. But that is a far, far cry from saying that there's actual clinical benefit or that people's lives are changed by drinking it. If you're putting a tiny amount in your half and half, it's probably you're not getting that much of a dose that would make a difference in your life anyway.
A new study says you'll sleep worse after a nightcap. A nightcap might help you drift off, but don't expect a good night's sleep for your trouble.
Was it a randomized controlled trial?
I don't know.
Well, so okay, then you got to give me a title. At least I can look it up while we're talking and, you know, and answer that. Because if that's a randomized controlled trial and they actually measured sort of objective measures of sleep, it's possible that that is true. I'm not, you know, I don't know that that's, because that has not been studied before as far as I know. I know that there's people that believe that alcohol consumption actually leads to worse sleep, and that, I believe, has been studied in a randomized control trial fashion. But this could be a new study that does that. Give me the title.
I can't find the name of the study here.
Or email it. Either one.
I'll instant message you the link.
Perfect. Oh, crap. I'm not on there.
Get on there. All right. Here's something that you blogged about, by the way. There is an ad. An ad was taken out by a doctor in Kentucky.
Yep.
And in the ad, he says he's closing down because after 20 years of practicing medicine, this doctor is closing down. And he even says in the ad, let me just read it, due to the policies of Obamacare, Stephen Kitek, MD, will be closing his medical practice on December 31st, 2013. Patients may pick up their charts at the office, gives the address of the office. Dr. Kitek wishes to thank all his patients that have visited his office over the past 20 years and apologizes for this inconvenience. You've written a blog post titled, "Yes, there's a doctor retiring in Kentucky. No, I don't care. You're an insensitive man."
Yeah, you know what? I stand by that one. I was going to say that was almost too snarky, but I just don't care. All right, here's the bottom line. You know, when they finally, like, because one, this was an ad, and yet everybody took it as gospel and started, you know, a lot of people started screaming, and I was getting plenty of emails and tweets about that, you know, look, this is the end. This is what's going to happen with all doctors. So, of course, thank God, someone in the media actually went and talked to the guy. So, first of all, let's own, he's 64 years old. He was nearing retirement. And his practice has no type of electronic medical record. And he recognized that in the future, lots of big bonuses are being paid out for having electronic medical records and meeting what we call meaningful use for them. And in the future, it's expected that there will be penalties for not stepping into the modern age and having electronic medical records. And we can debate the wisdom of that, but that is the law. And his office is evidently full of older Americans who don't. He described them as computer illiterate, and they didn't want to get electronic medical records, and so he decided to retire early. Instead of, remember, he's 64, he decided to retire early. But here's the thing. All of what I just said about bonuses and penalties for electronic medical records has nothing to do with Obamacare. That's the High Tech Act. It's part of ARRA. It's part of the stimulus. It has zero to do with anything with Obamacare. So he's retiring because he doesn't want to have electronic medical records. He doesn't like the High Tech Act, but he just, like many others, mistakenly lumps everything that he doesn't like into Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, and then just says that he's quitting just because of that. Not possibly because he's, you know, nearing retirement in 64 and made a ton of money in the practice of medicine and no longer feels like practicing. And not possibly because, you know, he just doesn't want to be forced to, like, update and have an electronic health record or anything that, you know, that regulation says he has. It's just Obamacare's fault, even though in his description he admits it has nothing to do with any of the legislation in the Affordable Care Act. And yet this is the kind of thing people just run with. Moreover, it's a... people retire every day. You know, every time someone retires from law, we don't have, you know, the whole world freaking out that, like, the legal profession is in danger. If a teacher retires, we say, yay, that's great, they're retiring, they're 64. He even got to retire a year early before his Medicare kicked in. I don't care. Especially when, you know, it's based on misinformation and stuff that's even not true about the Affordable Care Act, and yet people sort of grasp onto it. It's like, this is the problem with the law. There are plenty of legitimate reasons to dislike the Affordable Care Act. It just strikes me as odd at how we have to keep inventing new ones that aren't real in order to keep railing against it.
There was a very, very interesting piece that got a lot of clicks, a lot of reads at the Washington Post. It's a long read, and it's a thoroughly, I think it's a pretty well done piece. And you blogged about this as well, which is, and again, it's at the Washington Post. Here it is. The title is this: an effective eye drug is available for $50, but many doctors choose a $2,000 alternative. And as you write in your blog, TheIncidentalEconomist.com, everybody. The two drugs have been declared equivalently miraculous, tested side by side in six major trials. Both prevent blindness in a common old age affliction. Biologically, they are cousins. They're even made by the same company, but one holds a clear price advantage. Avastin, or how's it pronounced?
Avastin
costs about $50 per injection. Lucentis costs about $2,000 per injection. Do I need to read the article?
No, I mean, no, you don't. I mean, the bottom line is, like, they did an expose over how, you know, we keep using incredibly expensive medicines when absolutely dirt cheap alternatives exist, and this is costing us tons of money. And then they went on to talk about how pharmaceutical companies often use regulation and the courts to try to keep, you know, more cheaper alternatives sort of off the shelves or not being used. But they also, you know, they put some blame, which I believe is true, on physicians as well. Because, of course, physicians are the ones that choose and prescribe the medications. And we like to believe and we like to talk about the fact that, it's all patient choice or doctors are forced to do this. Or we try to, you know, justify it in some way and say that these are. But there are often times when there is no legitimate reason or no good reason to use the more expensive alternative. And yet doctors often do this, and it's a real problem in medicine, and it happens all the time. And it's a huge amount of spending. Granted, it wouldn't solve all our healthcare problems, but it's a problem, and it's a problem for this pharmaceutical industry too. Because if America ever wises up and fixes this, then they're going to lose a significant source of revenue, which of course they do use for many purposes, including research.
A big question about young people enrolling in the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and the exchanges, and a study out saying that President Obama, well, a lot of polling out on President Obama's approval rating, and it has really plummeted. It's at its lowest level right now. A new poll shows it's in the high 30s, I think, or even in the low 30s at one point. Its disapproval ratings are extremely high, and more and more young people are disapproving and have said, you know, if there were any way to take back the vote or recall the president, a huge percentage of them now would. And they're also saying that they're not going to enroll in the exchanges. They're not going to get health insurance through the exchanges. There's a lot of hysterics out there right now.
Yeah.
One thing that makes me comforted, because I support the Affordable Care Act and I think young people should enroll, is that that I don't worry about whether or not they will, is that it's the law. They actually have to. So
right.
you can not want to do something,
right.
And this was the really big issue that a lot of people, especially on the right, even though they came up with the idea, had, was that they're being forced to buy something. Well, that is the law. Supreme Court approved it. And so the concern about young people, whether or not they're going to enroll, isn't it just...
Yeah, it gets even deeper than that. First of all, let's start with the fact that, like, I have no doubt the president's approval ratings are lower. I don't care. That's a partisan poll. It's about politics. It's about whether he gets elected or not. It's about, you know, a person. And I've never cared. And, I, you know, again, it's like now I sound like I keep saying this about all different kinds of topics. But that has nothing to do with health policy. Interesting that, I rarely care about even how does the Affordable Care Act poll, because I think that's often just a proxy for, you know, how do people feel about Democrats or Republicans? You know, if you love the Affordable Care Act, you tend to be Democrat. If you hate it, you tend to be Republican, even though that's not entirely the case, but that's also a proxy. Ironically, even as the president's approval ratings have dropped, support for the law has almost been exactly the same, because it's sort of static. It's been the same forever. And so while everyone is freaking out about the president and his approval rating, they're automatically assuming that that translates into support or opposition towards the law. That's not the case. You know, when the president's approval rating was shockingly high, approval rating, then all the stories about how the Affordable Care Act was not polling very well. When the president's approval rating is low, I'm not seeing the stories, but the polls are pretty much the same about, you know, support for the Affordable Care Act, and I still don't care. We are hyperventilating about how many people say they're going to sign up. Well, I don't know why we can't just take a break and wait a couple months, and then we will have actual data on how many people actually signed up. And we will know whether people want to buy insurance and whether providing them this mechanism does it, or whether they're dead set against it and they won't do it, and in which case we need alternative reform and this is not working. We're just going to know. And as the rush to keep polling to see what's going to happen in a month, what's going to happen in a week, who cares? We're going to know soon enough, and we'll have an answer, and we will move forward, and it'll be time to put our money where our mouth is, and all the hyperventilating and partisan politics about guessing how this is going to go, we'll have an answer. But it's important to remember that, you know, young people can say they want to opt out, fine. You know, that is an easy way to rebel against the administration or your political party or, you know, strike a blow. But at the end of the day, there's a big difference between saying you're going to forego insurance and actually saying I'm not going to, and actually not having insurance, which is risky. And regardless of how people keep arguing about, you know, the benefits and, oh, I don't want it, it's freedom and all the other stuff, not having insurance is a monstrous financial risk. And most people insure their car because they're either by law or because they're afraid they're going to have an accident, or they insure their house because they're either by law or because they don't want to lose everything, and they insure themselves because they don't want to lose their financial stake if they get sick, and people get sick. You know, a third of Americans have a chronic health condition. Lots of people need insurance, and I've had insurance my entire life. I don't think I've ever been uninsured because I had enough money to buy it because I knew it was important. And even when I was young, I got insurance. I know you talk about all the time how your parents made sure you had insurance even when you were young, because we all recognize that's why we have insurance. And most of the people who are railing against the Affordable Care Act who have means make sure their kids have insurance, because it's important for financial security to have insurance. So there are lots of reasons, absolutely forgetting the individual mandate and all the partisan politics, that people want to have insurance. The vast majority of Americans are insured. You know, 85-86% of Americans or more have insurance today with no mandates whatsoever. Almost all the good jobs provide insurance because their workers demand it. They want to be insured. They recognize it's a problem. When young people go to get jobs, they often pick jobs that provide insurance because they want to be insured. So, you know, the idea somehow that all of a sudden people are going to forego it just because they dislike the president or his approval rating is low is strange. And I don't necessarily believe that that's going to happen. Having said that, we will see. In a couple months or a year, we'll have real data on whether people are truly rebelling against this. And if America hates it and America doesn't want it, they will elect people who will repeal it or change it. And that is how the country works. But the same rhetoric was used for Medicaid. The same rhetoric was used for Medicare. The same rhetoric was used for CHIP. The same rhetoric was used for expansions of the program. And they're all still around, because at the end of the day, when Americans get insurance, they tend to like to want to keep it. And so we'll see. We will absolutely.
My guest is Dr. Aaron Carroll. He's a health policy expert. He's a pediatrician, and you should follow him on Twitter if you're not already, at Aaron E. Carroll, two R's, two L's. Yesterday, Fox News, and part of the problem is the media, not just Fox News, but a lot of media, certainly the right-wing media, but the quote-unquote objective centrist media as well, does a lot of hit jobs on the piece and does a lot of inaccurate reporting to some extent. But one, and that's why the approval rating of the law is so low. If you believe everything you hear in the media, you probably would be terrified about what this law is going to do to your life. One story I saw, and then we'll go to phone calls, yesterday running across the banner on Fox News was something about fire departments. And I guess it's about volunteer fire departments that are going to find themselves out of money and unable to operate unless Congress or the Obama administration exempts them from the Affordable Care Act.
Why? If it's volunteer, are they paying for people's jobs?
Are they I don't know. Are you familiar with this story?
No, but I mean, just on its face value, if they're volunteer, why do they have to provide insurance?
Let me read from the piece, and you can raise questions quickly. The U.S. Department of Health takes the term volunteer literally, but the IRS says volunteer firefighters are technically employees if they're on the job for more than 30 hours per week, making them subject to Obamacare's employee mandate rules. Since the Obamacare law doesn't specifically carve out an exemption for them, fire departments where 50 or more people work, either as volunteers or officially as employees, are expected to provide health insurance for every one of them. In towns with more than one volunteer fire department, all the staffers will likely be lumped together for tax purposes, pushing many municipalities above the 50-worker threshold. That could cause fire departments, cost departments of lifesavers hundreds of thousands of dollars each year. Those that dump their volunteers in the federal insurance exchanges would still have no have to pay an annual $2,000 fine for each, quote, employee after the first 30.
Well, look, first of all, this is the kind of thing I'm going to look it up even while we're on break because I don't actually know the details of it. But if it turns out that that is true, yeah, that needs a fix. This is when it gets crazy. It's like the idea that this law is static and perfect is somewhat insane. If that is true, yeah, they need to fix the law. And you would hope that everyone on both sides of the aisle could come together and say, like, yeah, that's sort of crazy. You know, we should fix that and do that because I don't think anyone would argue that that is something that should occur. Are there problems with the healthcare system? Yes. Were there problems before? Yes. Will there be problems in the future? Yes. And we should fix those. And so if that is an actual issue, that should be a reason to amend the law to make sure that doesn't.
All right, well, look it up under the break and let us know what you find. 866-994-6343, at Aaron E. Carroll is here. One tweet question, and then we go to the phones. D. Walsh, 0615, tweeted both you and I, said, why don't the insurance companies cry foul when cheaper drug options are available since it's in their best interests?
Yeah, insurance companies do. I mean, you have to remember that if you look at most plans, what they do is they try to tier your benefits. So they say they'll pay, you know, you'll pay X amount for a tier one drug or a low-level generic drug, which often is free, to be honest, and then you pay a different amount for more, and then you pay more money for the super expensive drug. So they try to use financial incentives to try to drive you towards cheaper drugs. But that doesn't always work because, again, if a doctor tells a patient, I think you need the pricey drug, patients don't often fight. They are convinced, and sometimes the doctors are convinced. You know, they're human too, like that somehow that Nexium is better than Prilosec, even though they're exactly the same molecule. Or enantium, one ad doesn't have the enantiomer. Or that Sarafem and Prozac are, you know, different drugs when they are literally the same molecule.
Is that so?
Colored pill. Oh, literally the same molecule in a different color coding. And yet still some doctors will prescribe one versus the other. The doctors make that mistake. The second thing is that insurance companies often get special deals. So, you know, they will contract with pharmaceutical companies or pharmaceutical, you know, intermediaries to provide certain drugs at huge discounts. And so it doesn't cost them as much. But when the doctor writes the prescription, he doesn't know which insurance company has the deal with which drug. So some patients do great with that and some patients get horrifically screwed. And of course, the uninsured always get screwed because they're paying for it out of pocket. So it's not as easy. And believe me, insurance companies have been trying to fight this for a long time. They're not taking this on the chin and just walking away. They absolutely recognize this as a problem, and they're trying to find different ways to get it to be done.
Mario in New Jersey on that issue. Hey, Mario.
Yeah. Hi, how you doing, guys? Speaking of Aviston and the Lucentis debate, the interesting thing about the Post article was how the doctors really fought back against the company, the GreenTech Pharmaceuticals, and sort of demanded that they what was happening was they weren't selling the doses to the repackaging firm that would offer the Aviston in the lower doses.
Right.
So they, you know, they fought back, and the interesting thing was is 56% of the doctors used Avastin instead of Lucentis.
Oh,
and that sort of was heartening. You know, it's good to see the doctors actually getting involved. I'm not sure why they did it, but it's a good thing.
Yeah, and I'm not. First of all, I'm not saying all doctors, you know, are not doing the right thing. I'm not even saying that all doctors are evil for doing the wrong thing. Oftentimes, it's because they have been led by people that they trust, or because they're busy, to believe that somehow the more expensive drug is better in some way. It's just difficult to sort of get this through. Plus, you know, some doctors are busy. Sometimes patients demand the more expensive drug. It's not just the doctors.
No.
The doctors play a part in this. And I think for too long, we've seen a fairly large contingent of physicians who have fought, you know, this kind of involvement or who don't get involved. And at some point, we have to sort of take ownership for the idea that, we have a huge amount of power in the decision of how healthcare gets used. And knowing that the insurance companies have often abdicated on trying to reduce spending, and the government is often demonized for trying to reduce spending, and that we know a lot of this is coming out of patients' pockets, it's sometimes important for us to take the extra step to discuss directly with them, you know, that there may be cheaper but very cost-effective alternatives that might be in their best interest. And that's a conversation that doctors are not often comfortable having or have not been trained to have. And that is still probably something that we need to do in some situations. Now, there's no question. In some situations, the super expensive drug at all is all that exists and makes all the difference in the world. And what are you going to do? That's fine. But, you know, the All Hats study is decades old at this point. And just to briefly go over that, that was for hypertension. They did a study where they basically took a huge bunch of drugs in all different categories and did one of the largest, best comparative effectiveness studies ever, and looked at all different kinds of drugs in all different classes to see what worked best for hypertension. And at the end of the day, the best drug was what we call Lasix or furosemide. It's the cheapest of all of them, like pennies. And it worked the best. It beat out all the fancy designer drugs. And you would think that doctors would take those kinds of results and just, you know, start using the cheapest alternative, but they don't. And this study is from, like, the early 90s. Because we just don't translate this stuff into practice, and we just don't absorb it. And it's why sometimes comparative effectiveness research is necessary. But
well, what if the patient is – why doesn't the patient take more responsibility and
– No, know? Have you heard – You heard of the All Hat study? I mean, you know.
No, but I mean, put that aside for a second. In that, you know, you described the Prozac and the other drug as the exact same drug, same molecule.
How do they know? Because
you know.
Look, I'm doing this, but it's like, but even then, it doesn't trickle through. You know,
don't laugh at me, Mario. I'm saying, I don't know. I'm being Mario. Ignorant here. I don't have to pay for any drugs like that. But if I'm paying a lot of money for a drug, I might go do a little bit of research and say, hey, is there another drug just like this that's cheaper?
It's like you say about climate science, Pete. You trust the expert, right? So does the patient. They trust the doctor.
Well, one, I think they're the patient. Two, if you have to remember, if their doctor says to them, I think you need Nexium, Prilosec's not going to work, because they believe that. Really? Are they going to be – the number of patients who are truly skeptical of their physician to say, I'm going to go look up the molecules of those two drugs and see if they actually are different, and whether they're more than a me-too drug and an enantiomer of one or other, and actually – they're not going to do that. They're going to say they're busy and they have kids, or they have adult parents, or they're working three jobs, or they lost their job, and they're just going to take the prescription.
I know, but if something – but if something is that expensive – and maybe it's not, but if something
it's
that expensive –
always $2,000 versus 50. Sometimes it's 100 versus 25, or, you know, it's 200 versus 10. Or, you know, again, and because insurance is paying for most of it, it's the copay difference, which is 35 versus 8. And if your doctor says you need this drug, you don't question it. Like, you just do. And I mean, Austin actually had a blog piece a couple of weeks ago about he had a kidney stone and his doctors kept recommending tests, and eventually he got so frustrated, he's like, do I need that? And they're like, well, no, not really. But he didn't even question it, because if a doctor looks you in the eye and says, you're sick, you need this, This is what I'm, you do it. And they don't, we started this conversation with you saying, how can I tell if the research, most doctors can't. I mean, most patients can't. They can't figure out if Nexium is the same thing as Prilosec or Sarafen is the same thing as Prozac. They just aren't equipped to make that kind of judgment.
I'm just glad that you're my doctor and,
well, Dr. Carroll,
and best,
can I just
and best friend for life.
About, can you just talk a little bit about the shortage of residencies in the MD?
Yeah, well, I mean, okay, I mean, everybody talks about the fact that there's a doctor shortage. And part of that is that, you know, we can only train, you know, a certain amount of physicians because it's very expensive with the way we've set things up to train doctors. They have to have residency slots in the United States. And most residency slots, with the exception of those, I think, in children's hospitals, are paid for out of the Medicare program. Mm-hmm. And unless we sort of allocate significantly more money, we can't come up with more doctors or more residency slots. It's just not going to happen. It's very expensive to get them going. And, of course, since we don't seem to want to allocate any more money for anything these days, it's very hard to increase the number of slots and the number of doctors that we can train. And so we keep complaining about the doctor shortage, and we keep complaining about the fact that we're going to put more people into the system and how there won't be enough, but we're not acting to increase the number of physicians. And you can't increase the number of physicians overnight. It takes years to train someone to be a doctor. And it's a long, hard road. And so we have a shortage of the infrastructure to train physicians that makes this very complicated.
Thank you, Mario. Quickly to Kevin, who's a doctor in Massachusetts. You're on the air with Aaron Carroll, and then we'll take a break and get the rest of your calls. Quickly, Kevin.
Good morning, Peter and Dr. Carroll. I'm an internist, adult internal medicine in Massachusetts, and two comments. First, we're restricted by formularies, and with virtually no exceptions, we have to offer generic medications first. We would need to go through a lengthy process of obtaining prior authorizations through the insurance company to prescribe brand name medications. Second, in particular, talking about hypertension, I treat hypertensives every day. The number of middle-aged, younger, and even 60, 70-year-old people who tolerate Lasix, which you mentioned, is very low because of side effects. So we tend not to prescribe those, and Dr. Carroll, you'll know beta blockers because of side effects, even though they are very inexpensive. So it's not just simply that, you know, we don't want to prescribe cheap medicines.
Okay, first of all, this is, doctors always get their hackles up as if I'm accusing them of individually.
Lots of doctors
do the right thing. But even, so I would say two things. One, yes, you know, there are people who won't tolerate Lasix, but the ALHAT study didn't seem to have the level of intolerance that many people do see in practice. I don't, you know, no one knows why. So that's the first thing. Secondly, tons of the drugs that were expensive in the ALHAT study are now also incredibly dirt cheap because, again, that was in the early 90s. And yet still, those cheaper alternatives are used far less than the more expensive newer drugs that keep coming out of the pipeline. So the lesson continues, even if we don't go to Lasix.
I mean, as we enter more medical home and ACO risk contracts, we actually take a financial hit the more money we spend on pharmaceuticals. So
that is true.
There are definite incentives for us to prescribe more and more generic medications when appropriate.
Right.
I don't know what he just said at the beginning there, that last comment. What did he say as we enter?
That was an excellent point. He's saying that because of accountable care organizations, doctors are actually going to be responsible for sort of how much are spent on pharmaceuticals, and it's going to be a new lever and incentive for doctors and hospitals to push cheaper alternatives because they will lose money now if they don't. So this is the kind of thing that might get better in the future because of the, you know, different regulations in the Affordable Care Act. And I'm not claiming every doctor does this. I'm not claiming there are formularies that try to fix this. There are, you know, some doctors that do practice this way. It is, however, at a population level a problem. And a lot of people in private practice, especially that aren't, you know, under strict formularies and things like that, they choose sometimes more expensive alternatives. That's what the article is about, and that's what's borne out in sort of.
Before I go, Dr. Kevin in Massachusetts, Dr. Carroll in Indiana, a friend of mine recently had a vasectomy, and of course, after a vasectomy, you have to give a sperm specimen to see to make sure that there's no swimmers anymore. My friend was wondering, because he has to do that today right after his radio program. Like me, he hosts a radio program. If the time with which the specimen is produced and the temperature with it's stored matters, because my friend can't seem to find that. in the research. Do either of you know if either of those issues matter with a sperm specimen?
I think it probably would, in the sense that if you store it at the wrong temperature or the wrong way, that might theoretically kill the sperm that were alive and give you a false, give a false dead report.
What about time? I think it's room temperature you're supposed to keep it at. So what about time? Dr. Kevin, do you know anything about that for my friend?
Unfortunately, not my field.
Yeah,
I want to give you the wrong advice on that one.
I appreciate your honesty. I couldn't find that in the my friend couldn't find that in the instructions. Kevin, thank you. I mistakenly said my friend because I was looking at it for my friend. Of course. Dr. Kevin, thank you. We'll take a quick break. Back to the rest. What's that?
Everyone knows you don't have friends, so that's how they knew the lie.
You're my friend.
That's true. I just proved myself wrong. All right, go ahead.
We will get to Keith and Jason and Mark and even Burl when we come back. A lot of great questions for the expert, Dr. Aaron Carroll. At Aaron E. Carroll on the Twitter, if you want to harass him or give him a follow, you should be following him. A wealth of knowledge. Even knew what the OHOT study, whatever the hell that is. We'll be right back.
Stand up with Pete Dominic. You're listening to a radio bumper for a show. Now some music, then talking.
All right, Dr. Aaron Carroll is joining us, but first to Kelly in Florida. Kelly, you're on Stand Up. Go ahead, Kelly. Advice for my friend and his sperm sample. Kelly, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi, Kelly.
Hello?
Go ahead, Kelly. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was just answering your question before about the...
Yeah, I know. That's why I put you on the air. What's the answer for my friend?
If you care about room temperature and carrying it around in your pocket before you drop it off, if you're giving a sperm sample to see how fertile you are, you're getting a sperm sample to see whether there's any sperm present or absent. It's not going to matter that much because you're expecting to see zero. They say, we don't see any, and then you're good to go.
Right.
So it's not going to matter. I mean, don't put it in the freezer for 3 days and hand it to them, but, you know, the temperature is
irrelevant. I'll pass that along to my good friend.
All right. There you go.
I appreciate that advice. Dr. Aaron Carroll is joining us, as he does almost every Wednesday in the third hour of the program. Keith in New York, you're on Stand Up with Dr. Carroll. Hi, Keith. Go ahead.
Hey, Dr. Carroll.
Yep.
So one thing I just wanted to mention about that firefighter story, easiest problem ever to fix. All they have to do is rewrite the law, and it just highlights the dysfunction of Congress that they want to point to it and talk about it rather than actually doing it. There's nothing that can't be changed in, you know, a couple minutes with a pen stroke.
But if they don't change it, people will be outraged. And
local fire department in your town is going to close, and people are going to die horrific deaths. They might even show you, like, charred dolls for kids.
Well, it's not even that. I'm trying to work this through in my head. If they're volunteer, I mean, to be honest, I'm not a volunteer expert, like firefighter. If they're volunteer, does that mean they don't get paid?
Right. So many towns, New Jersey, where I live, 94 of the counties, about 90 of them are volunteer, but they work in shifts. So if they work in shifts, and I used to be a volunteer first aider, if they work in shifts, they have a set number of hours. The Department of Labor considers them, quote unquote, employees.
Where do they make their money? They have to earn money doing something. So do they not? They have other jobs?
Oh, yeah.
They'll get insurance for other jobs. And then the fire department won't have to provide them. Because, I mean, it's like either they're getting insurance through jobs that actually pay them, or they're making no money, in which case they qualify for Medicaid anyway. And the fire department, I can't figure out how this is actually occurring, other than increased paperwork and crap.
There are people that don't have other jobs that volunteer for them, some that, you know, work part-time in a couple of places. I mean, they're volunteer squads. You can look into it, and I could, you know, talk about them at length. But they do have a lot of issues with, you know, raising donations from people, and they don't have insurance, a lot of them. But
wouldn't it be nice if they could find a tax base to actually pay for the frickin' fire department anyway, and we didn't have to, you know, wait for volunteers to protect us like that, and we could pay people to do. I mean, there's so many problems with the story we're describing, and the Obamacare is the easiest one to fix.
My town has a paid fire department, and I have been advocating to make it volunteer. The volunteers actually have just as decent response times.
Oh, I don't question the quality. I just think it's ridiculous that we ask people to risk their lives for us on a volunteer basis. I'm actually thinking that's what sounds ridiculous to me, not the sense that, like, I think that we would get better quality. I'm sure that the firefighters, first of all, the fact that they're volunteering to work as firefighters is just remarkable. It just seems we would never ask people to volunteer to be soldiers or volunteer to be cops.
Well, I mean, we do not exactly pay soldiers what they would be worth in the private market.
No, but we still do pay them and pay for their insurance. We do that. I mean, they probably deserve more, but we do provide them with benefits and a salary.
Seeing how the VA operates, which brings us down.
All right, what else, Keith?
What?
Is that it?
So, no, I wanted to ask about electronic medical records. I was tweeting with you before, and I saw your link on the Incidental Economist. Is the problem that, you know, something that can be cured by a patient giving consent with HIPAA problems, or is there something much bigger in HIPAA that prevents electronic medical records from really taking hold?
Well, okay, no. We were talking specifically about mHealth. So I posted something this morning. There's an article in JAMA, which is going, yay, mHealth, it's going to change everything, which is basically means using mobile technology. I'm as always with technology skeptical. I do a ton of research in mobile technology. It's what I was doing Palm Pilot research when Palm Pilots were brand new. I was writing programs, building electronic medical records. I published research. I have grants in this stuff, and it doesn't work as well as we'd like everything else in the health information technology. Yet people think that, you know, any day now, mHealth and mobile technology are going to change everything. And I think what I said was, one of the things that people think is going to be great is that it's going to be great for communication. It's going to be great for allowing us to share information. And what I tweeted to you was that, yeah, except for the fact that HIPAA will make it incredibly hard. Doctors, you can't just send an email from one doctor to another talking about a patient unless it's heavily encrypted and you can be assured of meeting standards to make sure that the data can't be seen. I mean, the regulations are quite painful. And the idea that all of a sudden we can go to mobile sources where it's got to go through cellular, or other ways that are not encrypted necessarily, and, you're not sure of what network you're on, doctors are going to be shockingly hesitant to use, or hospital systems are never going to let them, to use mobile technology to start, zipping around personal health information. As panicked as they are about that on the internet, the idea that we're going to start doing that on our phones, which can leave their environment and be stolen or hacked or opened or, played with by your kids, it's just, there are so many steps that have to take place before this stuff will be ready for prime time or ready for, open use. We're barely getting there with computers, let alone, trying to do this in a cellular or mobile fashion. And so I'm just a little bit more cynical that this revolution is around the corner. I think that, mobile technology is great. I think it has a lot of potential. I also think the same of electronic health records and, clinical decision support. And yet for decades, they've been, going to be touting, they've been touted as they're going to revolutionize medicine any second now. And yet still the vast, vast, vast majority of doctors don't even have a computer or a medical record in their office. So I think there's potential. I think that there's a lot of problems, however, in the way, and that we have a long way to go.
I let Keith go a minute ago, but a good question. Jason in D.C. is calling. You've tangled the two of you before. It was very interesting. I look forward to hearing his question or comment. Go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, I was so glad you brought up the stuff about the differences in the medicines, where the genetic, molecularly exactly the same, but we get to mark them up in crazy ways. One of the things is, how come we just don't make it as simple as every hospital and medical procedure has to post all of the prices for it online, and the price has to be good just like it is at a menu at a restaurant?
They do that for, in some places, it's called all-payer rate setting, but most people think that that's government control of pricing. You have to remember that the price that they charge is not the same for everybody. They negotiate that with different insurance companies.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying as me as an individual, if I want to shop around for what it would cost my wife to get,
Fine, they'll give you what they have a price. It's just huge because they start very high, and then they don't work this way because the vast majority of people that they see – are insured. And so they don't charge the super high price or the charge master price to anybody but the uninsured. They only charge that price to people that don't have large negotiating power. No one who has insurance ever would pay that price, but no one who has insurance pays the same price, because even when you're dealing with the same insurance company, every different policy could have a different network, could have a different – I mean, the reason that there are networks that everybody's panicking about now is because insurance companies negotiate deals with doctors and practices and hospitals for certain prices. So the hospital, this is why it gets difficult. The hospital doesn't have necessarily a price that they charge. They would say, well, what insurance company do you have? Or, you know, how is that? And that's, they would look it up in some master table, and then they would tell you. And it's not loan it. It's not in their best interest to tell you. They're not telling you because they don't want to tell you, because then you could go around and negotiate and shop. And
so basically what they're doing is making it so that there can be no real free market where their invisible hand can function.
There's no free market. There will never be a free market in medicine because, again, for all the reasons I said before, they have you over a barrel.
My dermatologist only takes cash. I know another dermatologist does the same thing. I can shop between the two of them because of the procedures, because I know what their prices are.
What kind of procedures are you getting from the dermatologist?
You know, regular. I'm not going to go into medical stuff that I'm talking about, but it's a little bit more complicated. It's a little bit more complicated. I mean, these are like in-service type of things that you would do.
Right. Okay. So you can offer.
It's not like he's just looking at me for 5 minutes.
I get that, but the free market that exists in medicine, more often than not, is for things that are not necessarily medically necessary, and that's the only reason I ask. Like things like LASIK, which is great, but I wear glasses. I don't want LASIK, and I have an unbelievably cheap alternative. And so no one agrees that LASIK is a necessary procedure, so it has a quote-unquote free market. Breast augmentation has a quote-unquote free market. Lots of plastic surgery has a quote-unquote free market because people only pay cash. The doctors would never think to bill insurance, and that operates a free market. But anything that falls under the I have to have it because I'm ill rarely works in that same type of system. No oncologists operate on a cash-only basis. Almost no surgeons.
So the Surgery Center of Oklahoma that posts all of their
prices online. I know that there
online,
are exceptions. Why isn't
that used as a model? Because it seems like their prices are 20 cents on the dollar compared to what the local hospitals would be. As a matter of fact, because people now have the Surgery Center of Oklahoma, for example, having their prices posted online and they're good for 60 days,
right,
people now can go back to the hospitals, and the hospitals are running into problems because essentially this is what's been going on. The medical establishment doesn't want you to know what the prices ever are.
That way
you're constantly confused. So
I
here's
totally
the, so what if the solution be making it so that everybody has to know what your prices are.
But things like Oklahoma work only because they're the exception, not the rule. If the entire system worked that way on a cash-only basis, then anyone who couldn't afford it would be 100% out of luck. There would be no fallback. So it works. It works for as long as there's a massive system which takes up the slack for people that don't have cash in hand to pay for their surgeries, which is the vast majority of people in the United States. And so, again, that works as an exception as long as the rest of the system is in place. We could go to a Wild West type system where, you know, it's cash only and things cost, you know, are perhaps cheaper.
20
than
seconds.
Now, but then the vast majority of Americans couldn't afford it and will be out of luck if they got sick. And so that system works for some, but for very few.
Wasn't needed the most. But a great question and comments from Jason. And we're out of time, unfortunately, because that was fascinating. Dr. Aaron Carroll, thank you very much, as always. We're out of time. That's it. Stay tuned for the replay. Great program today. Thank you all for contributing. Be the change you want to see in the world. We'll talk to you tomorrow.